Hello everyone, my name is Phil Blancato, and I'm CEO and President of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management, a division of Advisor Group. Today is July the 15th. Here we are in the dog days of summer. Amazing how quickly things go by. Hopefully you're enjoying the warm weather. Finally here on the East Coast, it's warmed up, and we're having a great summer. It's been dry and actually pretty comfortable. Normally we get pretty humid this time of year, and this year has been much better. In fact, we're starting to spend our days down at the beach, which is always a nice thing to do when it gets this warm. Well, another fascinating week. As we get through quarter end here and begin the third quarter of the year, there were higher expectations for the third quarter, that we would be in a profound rebound, and that the terrible data coming out in the second quarter would be buffeted by the solid rebound that was going to begin in July and extend through the fall. But instead, here we are once again in the midst of some controversy. Can we reopen schools and get them going again? Can people go back to work? Is the second wave so significant that it's going to have a lasting impact on economic growth? Can we even have growth with a second wave? New questions that we are not indifferent to what we've seen in the past, but certainly reasons for pause. Certain to take a hard look and understand if the economics of the overall environment are going to be profoundly impacted by what's quote-unquote a second wave, if it truly is one or is it just an extension of the first one. Well, as we dive right in here, first let's start off at the topic where we always begin, the latest on COVID and what's happening. There's really a lot of different ways to look at it from what's important to you, whether it's the fact that the fatality rate in the United States continues to stay at or below 1% in almost every single state. The fatality rate around the world continues to stay about 1% of total population. When you look at the current fatality rate of those getting sick, it's only about 4%. It's come back down from as high as 6%. We see across the globe an improvement in the number of people who are passing away, and that's certainly a credit to the medicines that have been used, the therapeutics, the hospitalization procedures, and to a degree, younger people getting the virus. For example, there were 242 deaths from COVID on Monday, May, July the 6th. That's down 86% from the peak of 1,765 deaths on April the 2020. So a significant change. However, new cases are going higher. When you look at the number of new cases that are happening right now, we are averaging around 60,000 plus per day. That's the highest since the pandemic began. But in that same vein, the number of people are passing away, which were at one point significantly higher in that anywhere from 2,000 to some days almost 2,500 per day, is now somewhat consistently below 500. In fact, the seven-day moving average of deaths is lower over the last week, not higher. And then more importantly, of the new cases that are coming up with it, Florida, California, Texas, and Arizona, these hard-hit areas, we're seeing significant new cases every single day. What we're starting to see is a mild tick up in the number of people going into the ICU. And albeit places like Arizona, which are now right about only 10% left of occupancy in their ICU, in sheer numbers, number of people, that means they've added about 400 people to their ICU. So sometimes the numbers versus the percentages can be somewhat unusual. But there is no doubt that in some states, we are still seeing an increase to the ICUs. And we got to be careful of a place like a Florida, which has got about an 18% ICU availability at this point, down from about 25. But in places like California, where they still have plenty of ICU bed space left, it's a bit about what might happen rather than what is happening. In fact, when you look across the country, believe it or not, ICU beds, when you look at the whole country, which is a little disingenuous, is only about 10% of hospitals are currently ICU patients in them. So of the entire population in the ICU countrywide, 10% of them are from ICU or are from COVID related. So a little bit different scenario when you start looking at the pure data. When you really get under the covers here, it makes you believe that while there is reasons for concern, we're not quite there yet. When you look at the overall virus and where it's at, certainly it continues to spread, and there has been spikes in numerous countries around the world, not just us. There are a few different areas to be concerned about. Specifically, today there's roughly 13.5 million people globally that are confirmed to have it. Roughly 600,000, not quite there yet, just shy of 600,000 have passed away. Then you get into the data here. The total active cases is right now at 5 million. So that means you've had just about 6.5 million, almost 7 million people recover from it. There have been 8,500,000 cases with an outcome, and as I mentioned, just actually a little bit higher, 7.8 million have recovered, 582,000 have passed away. The fatality rate was up near 6%, and it's come all the way down to 4.3%, so really an improvement as far as people passing away. And then, it is fair to give some credit to the United States medical system, where today we have 3.5 million people who have been impacted by the virus with 139,000 fatalities, and Europe had over 2.6 million, so about just a little, almost a million less than us with 197,000 fatalities. So when you look at it in total, no doubt that we've done a better job managing the impact on our population. One of the things that we've talked a lot about is warmer weather, and whether or not the virus would have a profound impact when the weather got warmer. And here we are with lots of warm weather, like here in New Jersey, and yet the virus is still spreading pretty rapidly. Well, we've come to find out that study after study has shown that sunlight can inactivate the virus on surfaces and in the air. But the problem is, unlike the flu, we don't have a lot of people in the country yet who have gotten the virus. So in other words, it's still spreading significantly in spite of the fact that the climate is helping us. Put another way, human beings' behavior kind of trumps the idea that climate could eliminate the virus. So certainly it is helping, but there's still such a low immunity to the disease around the country that it's spreading still quite easily in spite of the sunlight. And believe it or not, there's a number of different expectations or beliefs that air conditioning is having a big impact, because air conditioning systems today move the air through a building quite efficiently, and yet in most cases there's not a preventative in the air conditioning system from it impacting other people. So in warm weather states, you're spending a lot of time indoors where it's very easy to get the virus. And let's not forget, the way you get the virus is being in a room with somebody for an extended period of time, more than 15 minutes. Neither one has masks on. That person is aerosolizing the virus. They're sneezing, they're coughing, they're leaving droplets in the air. And sometimes those droplets get picked up by a system and passed around. So it is a highly contagious virus, and albeit that sunlight's helping, it's not eliminating as we had hoped it would. And when you look at other countries around the globe, there is, certainly a difference between us and places like Europe. If you look at Italy today, their case rate is still very low, only about 200 per day, and we're up in the 50,000 some days. You look at places like South Korea and Taiwan. South Korea is having a bit of an uptick. Taiwan's still flat. And the reason why, when you look back at it, they were a bit more strict in their shutting down process. We went at this with a statewide or state-controlled system, where they did a national system. And I guess you could debate which way's better. We're a nation of states, and they're not really. But certainly, we took a different approach, and for us, it hasn't worked. As of late, you're seeing a significant spike. Even though it's not resulting yet in significant pressure on hospitals or fatalities, there is a new spike in cases, and we'll see what comes of that, because it certainly could lead to that. But so is Brazil, to a degree Russia, South Africa, and even Mexico having spikes in there. So there are variances around the world. But it's not fair to say we're the only country that's having a problem. There are other countries that are having some issues as well, and that's something worth monitoring, because it affects global trade and our own economy both ways. So it's something to be considered. When you look at places like Israel that are pushing back, the sectors, the religious sectors of the area are frustrated with being locked down for a long period of time. So you're seeing some pushback in places that we haven't seen some in the past. And even France today is enacting a mask policy for their first time, mandating masks that if you don't wear one, in fact, you could be fined, like you can in Germany. And now in certain states, the United States, you could be fined if you don't wear a mask, like New Jersey, where I live. That is now a real aspect of the economy, and something we need to think about as we reopen up. Some of the thoughts out there around whether or not there is a potential to solve this thing. Just the CDC came out and said, if we all wore masks in environments that require them, when you're in a crowded place, or you're indoors, or you're around people that you don't know. There is this opportunity that if we all wore masks for the better part of 8 weeks, in fact, we could actually stop the spread of the virus, because the transmission rate of the virus would fall below 0.6. It means for every person that gets it, they're affecting 0.6 people, which eventually would cause it to stop spreading. So the three C's of the virus, closed spaces, crowded places, and close contact conversations, are what spread it. And the CDC's come out and said that's the key for us to be able to continue to open up the economy, or at least maintain what's gone on so far. And I think there's real value in understanding that, because as we do have this lumpy opening where some states are still opening up and growing in their economy and others are having to hold back now, no doubt there's concerns around how we're going to be able to open up and protect people. Because even though that, you know, we know it's older folks who are really taking the brunt of the fatalities, we still want to be able to protect them. And to do that, we may need to make sure that younger people who are getting it right now are getting it less, simply because we don't want to have a trickle-down effect or a tangential effect by someone getting it. So, you know, it is the salons and the restaurants that have caused this, and we're seeing maybe some social unrest, a demonstration as well, but we're seeing some movement to correct that. So hopefully this is the beginning of that. And as I mentioned, while the mortality rate is good, there's some other good stats I just want to touch on. Let's talk about California for a minute. California has 7,881 ICU beds. Based on the current data, we estimate that there's 38% of those, or 2,994, are currently occupied by non-COVID patients. That means 1,886 are occupied by COVID patients, or 23%. So as I mentioned earlier, the average countrywide is about 10%, California being a bit higher, but still the bulk of their people in the ICU are not from COVID. And believe it or not, they have 38% of their hospital beds available. Look at it in a different way. Of the 7,000 people who have passed away, 5,390 are over the age of 65. So the data still tells us we can open up the economy. We just need to do so that we protect the folks who are most vulnerable. And part of that protection is going to be required that younger people don't get it and carry it to them. What we have noticed in places like Arizona and Florida are similar statistics. Slightly higher ICU bed occupancy. As I mentioned earlier, Arizona is down to only about 10% availability of their occupancy. In fact, today it improved a little bit, so it's actually 12 as of today, unless something changes here in the last few hours. But, you know, we're realizing that there's still some concern in a place like Texas, where they had 6,663 ICU beds. Of that, 42% are currently occupied by non-COVID, but 43% are COVID-related. Now, there are 11,400 available hospital beds left. There were 12,295 as of last week. There are over 1,000 ICU beds, or 14% ICU beds available. So that number's tightened quite a bit. But looked at a different way, I think it's helpful to know that when you look at the 7-day moving average of cases, California went from an average of 7,500 a day up to 8,800 a day, an increase of 18%. Texas went from 7,500 to 9,700, so almost 20% increase. Arizona, from a 7-day moving average, is actually down 11%. So we're seeing they were the first ones to roll back some restrictions, and it's helping. And maybe the others are due to follow. And Florida up 27%, but as of right now, they have excellent ICU beds. They have just about 20% of their ICU beds available. So not terribly serious yet. But looked at a different way. When you look at deaths per week, and we're very concerned about people passing away, in California, we had a 37% increase in the number of people dying. That's a huge increase. But in physical numbers, that number represents actually 26 people. We went from 70 people average per day passing away to 96 on average passing away per day. So while in a percentage number for a big state like California, we would think it'd be thousands of people, it's actually not. So sometimes the percentages can be a little bit confusing. When you look at the raw data, it's not always the case. Texas, for example, went from 46 on average per day to 83, representing an 80% bump. But reality is it's, you know, just about 40 people. So I think it's something to be considered. And then, by the way, in all these states, California, Texas, Arizona, Florida, all have a fatality rate of right around 1%. And there are many other states that have even lower than that. So the mortality rate in those states, while gone a little bit higher recently, still not anywhere significant. So I think that's something we said. And then separately, testing in all those states is also up significantly. California's tests per day are up 28%. California 7%, Texas 7%. So you'll see a real significant increase in testing there. So it's a quick update on the virus, and no doubt it's still spreading. There are lots of people getting it, but I think we can safe to say that there is some underlying points that we can monitor and be rest assured that there is some success at hand around it, and that we can be a little less concerned for now. It could get worse, but for now a little less concerned about the long-term outcome because as of now we're able to hold on to the mortality rate and it's doing okay. When you think about where we go from here, You know, today the stock market is up a bunch because of a company called Moderna. And Moderna has come out and said of the 45 people that they went through phase two trials of their vaccine, all 45 have showed a real resilience to the creation of antibodies. So huge success. They are beginning phase three trials on July 27th with upwards of 30,000 people. That's significant. So an American company has an American drug that we can inoculate Americans. Forgive me for being not trying to be overly American or too pro-American in that way. I'm not trying to sound that way, but for the health and benefit of our economy, it's critical that we have access to a vaccine that we can use. Because there are other companies in the world that are doing well. One of them is called CanSino. It's a Chinese company, and they're in phase three trials, and they actually don't have enough sick people in China, so they're going to Brazil, Chile, and Saudi Arabia and Russia to find people they can inoculate. But obviously they're going to worry about their own population first, and we want to, you know, obviously worry about Americans first. So excited that they're moving along. There's a new drug out of Moscow, the repurposing a drug out of Japan that was for another virus, which they bought the rights to, and they're in phase two trials, and they'll get results in August as well. But I would assume Russia would want to worry about their 250 million people before our 330 million. Now, in fairness, the whole globe is cooperating, so hopefully that's a scenario that we can all participate in, but, you know, that's something to be noted that we have an American company doing very well here. Merck has also entered finally. Merck has been a company that, for the most part, has stayed out of this and as of late have jumped into the virus front because they want to participate in it as well. Pfizer with BioNTech, a German company, that partnership seems to be going extremely well, that they're also going into phase three trials. It's really a global company, but certainly a very strong American footprint based in the United States, and would have 30,000 participants in their study starting in just a few weeks as well. So two companies coming to market, which really has boosted the market, because believe it or not, as of today, the S&P 500 is no longer down on the year. It has rallied all the way back and made up for all of its losses, in spite of us looking at some of the worst economic data in our lifetime. It really is pretty impressive that how far the market has come simply on the expectations of where the market can go from here, or where the virus can go from here, and what the medical community can help us boost it up. Let's not forget how much the Federal Reserve has helped out limiting the pain of this scenario, certainly, but no doubt that there has been an ongoing opportunity for the market to hold on because of the announcements like Moderna. And another drug I've mentioned recently is the existing drug called remdesivir by Gilead. That has shown to be a really strong therapeutic or an antiviral. Basically, 62% of the people who are in the hospital, you know, really in very difficult scenarios, are able to take this drug and recover. So that means of the people going into the ICU, 62% now have an opportunity to get better. Couple that with the steroid drug dexamethasone, which is an existing steroid that's been around for a long time. Sorry, I have trouble saying that word, dexamethasone. It's globally available, it's very inexpensive, and it helps bring down inflammation in the lungs. Why that's important is those are the reason why people are passing away, is they can't breathe. And so remdesivir, coupled with dexamethasone, are able to really reduce the fatality rate. And that's why we're seeing new cases go higher, and yet the fatality rate is actually going lower in most cases. So it's exciting that the medical community is finding ways to help us get through this. And certainly there's something to be very excited about. So whether it's BioNTech or Moderna, even the Oxford drug, remember in the past I've mentioned AstraZeneca, is also going into phase three trials here. So there's a number of companies really being very aggressive to get us onto a better place from the drug standpoint. One name that you haven't heard me mention before is a company called Emergent BioSolutions. They're actually working with Mount Sinai Hospital to have a plasma drug. So that's a different take on things, where they're going to have a plasma drug that would allow for a pill that would replicate as if you're getting plasma antibodies from someone who's recovered from the virus. So that's a really neat and different approach that I think is very exciting. And I think it's something to be said for the idea of, you know, being creative here, because if something like that works, it doesn't have to be done intravenously. It's a very simple pill that you could take to get better. It's in initial trials right now with a bit of a ways to go here. So the market has come very far, very fast, simply because of the idea that there is potential relief here. And the relief comes both economic and from the medical community. Well, we've talked a bit about the medical community. Let's switch over to the economic event. You know, to us, this has always been a V-shaped recovery. This is probably going to be the shortest recession of our lifetime. Obviously, the first and second quarter are going to be negative. Second quarter GDP growth or gross domestic product is probably going to be negative 40%, the worst number in your lifetime. There are more people unemployed right now than any time in your lifetime, regardless of how old you are, pretty much, unless you were old enough to be alive in during the Great Depression. And since that's unlikely the case, this is some seriously poor data. However, in an event-driven recession where something terrible happens to the marketplace, liken it to a bad hurricane, and then suddenly the hurricane's gone and we're in this recovery mode, you know, by the third quarter, we should be in growth mode again. So there's three phases to an event like this. There's phase one, where you are really the shock and awe, the destruction of of the marketplace and the economy. Phase two, where you kind of get into the sideways pattern of realizing what's happening and can you begin to build. And three, where you have a healing process, where you start to grind higher. And I've likened this to a bit of a Nike swoosh. You know, you have that front of the swoosh that goes straight down, and then it grinds slowly higher up the side of the sneaker. To me, that's the best way to describe the environment that we're in. So we're out of phase one, we're out of phase two, and we're beginning phase three, which is that healing process. Now, there could be some fits and starts in there simply because of the second wave and how serious this is going to be. And truth be told, when you talk about the second wave, there are some concerns, no doubt about it. When you look at activity, both globally and domestically, but especially domestically, of the last 14 days and specifically the last 7, there is a turndown. We are watching that nice uptick from the bottom, specifically in restaurants and bars, consumer spending areas, weaken a bit, especially in the Sun Belt areas. So there is a important impact of this idea that as we begin to have a second wave, there's no doubt that people get very concerned and they begin to spend less. When you look at open table reservations, people making reservations in places like Arizona, or you go to places where we've seen good spending initially because they came out of a lockdown earlier, and now that's actually no longer the case. They're locking back down and it's having an impact. So, for example, when I look at countrywide data, mortgages were down 35% at the worst year over year. Now they're up 33%. But yet, when you talk about restaurants, which were down 100%, now we're down 58%. So they've improved, but you can see as of late, there's a bit of a turndown. When we look at the most recent economic data in places like Arizona, in places like Texas and Florida, the number of people going to restaurants is off by anywhere from 5 to 10% in just the last week. And that's partially because some of these things are closing down. And we're seeing online retail spending tick up again. So where we were getting a little bit of a transition back to things being normal, that's kind of off the table right now, simply because most people are concerned about going out and getting the virus with all these folks going out there and getting sick. So that does make a difference. And the most recent, we call it mobility of the average consumer out there, is easing. And it's easing. In fact, when we look at each state, it kind of breaks down where there's been a tightening or a pausing or not doing anything at all. It doesn't really matter, believe it or not. The psyche of the American consumer nationwide is affected by the fact that in certain local environments, whether they're in their state or not, is causing people to be more careful. So in other words, looked at a different way, the deteriorating situation in the Sun Belt, you know, those states I've already mentioned, is causing people around the country to rethink the amount of money they're spending and how they're spending it. You know, it is causing reduced spending as of the last 2 weeks. We are seeing a trend that even at the local level, people are being more careful, and that the new cases are reducing activity, economic activity. So that's not great, because we expected the economy to turn around much more going into the third quarter, and this may slow it down a bit. So yes, we've seen a bounce off the bottom, as I just mentioned, but no doubt there's some concerns as to how much we can keep this going, and if in fact it's going to be as strong as we expected it to be. With a rebound as great as 25% expected to be in the third quarter, maybe it'll only be 10 or 15. But key here, still positive. We're not expecting another horrific second quarter like we got this time around, because we are not completely closed. We are opened up to a degree and opening up carefully and smartly. And I think the narrative is just that. That as the economies open up here, we're going to have to be careful whether we go back to school or not. It's going to be what's the infectious rate in your area? How serious is it? Is there a smart way to be in school? And can we let that activity begin? Because school has so many unintended consequences, whether it's parents going back to work or the custodian being in the building or a teacher, and certainly the money that they make. There are a lot of money made from schooling. And that's why it's so important that they get back there from a learning standpoint, a personal standpoint, and an economic standpoint. But can we do it safely? And that's going to be the ongoing debate here as we open up and see a spike in cases. And by the way, we're not the only ones. When you look around the rest of the world, you know, certainly Spain is off a little bit with concerns. Germany's off a little bit with concerns. The United States. Now, this is new because even overseas, they have little pockets of cases. So they're trying to be very careful and as to the right way to do this. What it comes down to is sort of a heterogeneity approach of opening up the economy. In that sense that you need a diversified approach and that you want to protect the vulnerable from transmission, but still allow those who can go back to work to go back to work. And that narrative is going to be interesting because you're seeing different countries and different states take a very different approach to it. And that's why you see such a variance around the United States and around the globe. I think there's something to be said for this idea that, you know, there is a long way to go before we're there, and the therapeutics will help us. But the idea of us working together now is probably more critical than ever if we can do that. On the economic front, part of the reason why the stock market has done so well here is we did see the banking sector come in very strong. Banks like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs reported earnings today, and they beat expectations quite handily. And that was a bit of a surprise because they made a lot of money on trading and investment banking. They did, however, both companies put aside billions of dollars for loan loss that they are expecting numerous small companies to come up for a loan or have to default on some debt because they're just not making enough money to be able to support themselves. So that's a concern, but they did well. And why that's important is when the banks are healthy, it gives them the ability to lend. And when they have the ability to lend, it's a stimulant for the U.S. economy. But by the way, let's not get past this. The earnings season, how much companies make for the second quarter is probably going to be down around 40%. The hardest hit sectors are probably going to be banking. Even though we saw J.P. Morgan do well, some of those small little banks are probably going to have a very difficult time. Discretionary areas could be down significantly. You think about places like retail and leisure and tourism, you know, restaurants, hotels, so on, down as much as 60%. You'll probably see technology and healthcare companies hang in there, be down, but hang in there. But you're looking at not only the worst economic data of our lifetime, more unemployed people of our lifetime, but certainly the slowest corporate growth of our lifetime as well. And you got to take those into consideration when you're thinking about the stock market roaring to all-time highs. So why is the stock market up so much? Well, part of the reason is it's really the only game in town. You see, the 10-year U.S. Treasury is yielding just around 0.66 of 1%. So can you imagine, you loan your money to the Treasury for 10 years, and they give you back 0.66 every year. That's actually less than the rate of inflation. The most recent inflation data suggests inflation is going to grow around 1% for the foreseeable future. So you're losing money every day by loaning it to the federal government. And the other reason why the stock market is doing so well is how much you earn. The total amount of dividends versus the total return of the stock market is about, on average, 4% per year. And that's not the price return of the stock market. When we talk about earnings, how much individual companies are earning in the stock market, they're earning around 4% a year on average, even in spite of this really bad second quarter. We call that the earnings yield. Generally, that means how much do they pay you in a dividend and what other monies do they give you on top of it and how valuable are the companies. It's a separate way to look at the market. But even just pure dividends, if you're earning around 2.5% yield on the S&P 500 and the bond market's just giving you 0.66, well, then it's a much better deal to be in the stock market than the bond market. Add to it that people are flush with cash to some degree. There are lots of folks. Remember, consumers were in good shape going into this, especially those who have the ability to invest in a market like this. So in that reason, certainly people are willing to invest in the equity market, and that's part of the reason why it's held up so well. The other reason why is the Federal Reserve has come in and said the corporations will loan you money if you need it, limiting bankruptcies. They've also loaned money to small businesses and people, which have all been very supportive. So the Fed is the buyer of last resort, but helping out. So when you look at the valuations of stocks, you've heard me talk about how they're not inexpensive. But when you consider how expensive the bond market is and how much liquidity there is out there, it stands to reason that the stock market, while not cheap, is not overly expensive either. It's about fairly valued, if not modestly expensive. However, the stock market could go higher. If this second quarter turns out to be better than we expected and we get control of the virus sooner than expected, it's not out of the question to consider the S&P could go as high as 4,000 in the next 12 months simply because you're looking at a bond market that just doesn't reward you enough to be in it, and the Federal Reserve continuing to be very accommodative, helping out. And so while the tech sector I would expect to lead the way, any sort of economic recovery would help the banks. It would help the big manufacturers like the Caterpillars of the year of the world, and with the ability to actually turn things around. When all the globe is doing well, even, you know, every central bank in the world is not doing well, lending money. Europe is going to lend $1 trillion. China's lending money as well in their economy, pushing money into the economy. So is Japan. When all these big central banks are doing that, it makes it harder to lose money in stock markets. In fact, the Federal Reserve has been cutting interest rates for the better part of 30 years now. And for that reason, we like to believe that it's a support mechanism for the marketplace. So what I'm surmising all this is certainly the stock market is not inexpensive. And as I mentioned already, stocks have become wildly volatile, but gone basically straight up from the bottom of the market and now up for the year. But with the Federal Reserve helping out, with lots of liquidity available to them, lots of liquidity in the marketplace, honestly, less expensive than the bond market, that makes the stock market relatively attractive, and that's why it's done so well as of late. Earnings season is going to be bad, and the unemployment numbers probably aren't going to get a heck of a lot better. We did see something interesting come out. Small businesses, we have a small business optimism index. It came in at a 104. It came in at a 100.6 on a scale of basically 60 to 120. That is actually a reading that's not that dissimilar from February before the pandemic began, which was a 104. So small businesses are showing some real optimism in here. One final point. Let's not forget that the stock market's very narrow. The top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 are up anywhere from 10 to 14% on the year, where the bottom 50 are still down roughly 35 to 40% on the year. So there's only a handful of stocks that are really leading the way, and that makes for a scary market. You want to make sure you're very diversified and high-quality companies that can handle some of the volatility that comes from time to time. And then finally, I think I'd wrap this all up by saying another week has gone by, and as we go by and watch in awe as the stock market's recovered, but be very concerned about the second wave. Be concerned about that we're not yet in control of the virus. Be concerned that the medical community, while advancing, isn't quite there yet. So in an environment like this, it means you be in a neutral position. You want to participate in the markets, but you don't want to get overly aggressive here because there's still quite a few unknowns as to when we're actually going to get a therapeutic or a vaccine, when we will see the economy begin to open up again and not begin to slow down again. We're seeing some slowing. And in fact, whether it's which company is going to win the battle for the vaccine, there's a lot of still questions to be answered. So our approach is be conservative, participate in the market, be aware that there's plenty to come. Heck, don't forget we got an election season right down the road, which I'm sure is going to be very tumultuous. You roll it all together, it's exciting times because we're learning so much, but certainly we're very cognizant of the personal loss of people passing away, the economic loss and the impact it can do, and the really still only some of the unknowns about how far the virus is going. And for that reason, be careful, be safe, be neutral in your portfolios, hold high-quality investments. Wear a mask when you're outside in public. It's proven to work. I think the CDC is right that if we all wear a mask when we're in situations that are outside the normal environment we're in, we might get control of this thing sooner than we all like to believe. Maybe this event here is scaring us into doing that, and hopefully we, like Europe, we can get this thing in control sooner rather than later. I hope you stay safe wherever you are. I look forward to talking to you again. If you ever have any questions, ask your financial advisor. We'll try and get them answered for you. Thank you for your time today, and look forward to talking to you all real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.